idea where she was going until she came to Prestille Street. 3 minutes later, she was parking in Andrea Grinnell's driveway. Yet this house was also dark. There was no answer to her soft knocks. Having no way of knowing that Andrea was in her bed upstairs, deeply asleep for the first time since dumping her pills, Julia assumed she had either gone to her brother Dougie's house or was spending the night with a friend. Meanwhile, Horace was sitting on the welcome mat, looking up at her, waiting for her to take charge, as she had always done. But Julia was too hollowed out to take charge and too tired to go further. She was more than half convinced that she would drive the Prius off the road and kill them both if she tried going anywhere. What she kept thinking about wasn't the burning building where her life had been stored, but of how Colonel Cox had looked when she'd asked him if they had been abandoned. Negative, he'd said, absolutely not. But he hadn't quite been able to look at her while he said it. There was a lawn glider on the porch. If necessary, she could curl up there, but maybe... She tried the door and found it unlocked. She hesitated. Horace did not. Secure in the belief that he was welcome everywhere, he went inside immediately. Julia followed on the other end of the leash, thinking, "My dog is now making the decisions. This is what it's come to." "Andrea," she called softly. "Andy, are you here? It's Julia." Upstairs, lying on her back and snoring like a truck driver at the end of a four-day run, only one part of Andrea stirred, her left foot, which hadn't yet given up its withdrawal-induced jerking and tapping. It was gloomy in the living room, but not entirely dark. Andy had left a battery-powered lamp on in the kitchen, and there was a smell. The windows were open, but with no breeze, the odor of vomit hadn't entirely vented. Had someone told her that Andrea was ill? With the flu, maybe? Maybe it is the flu, but it could just as easily be withdrawal if she ran out of the pills she takes. Either way, sickness was sickness, and sick people usually didn't want to be alone, which meant the house was empty. And she was so tired. Across the room was a nice, long couch, and it called to her. If Andy came in tomorrow and found Julia there, she'd understand. "She might even make me a cup of tea," she said. "We'll laugh about it." Although the idea of laughing at anything ever again seemed out of the question to her right now. "Come on, Horace." She unclipped his leash and trudged across the room. Horace watched her until she lay down and put a sofa pillow behind her head. Then he laid down himself and put his snout on his paw. "You be a good boy," she said, and closed her eyes. What she saw when she did was Cox's eyes not quite meeting hers, because Cox thought they were under the dome for the long haul. But the body knows mercies of which the brain is unaware. Julia fell asleep with her head less than 4 feet from the manila envelope Brenda had tried to deliver to her that morning. At some point, Horace jumped onto the couch and curled up between her knees. And that was how Andrea found them when she came downstairs on the morning of October 25th, feeling more like her true self than she had in years. 16. There were 4 people in Rusty's living room. Linda, Jackie, Stacy Moggin, and Rusty himself. He served out glasses of iced tea, then summarized what he had found in the basement of the Bowie funeral home. The first question came from Stacy, and it was purely practical.
"Did you remember to lock up?"
"Yes," Linda said.
"Then give me the key. I have to put it back."
Us and them, Rusty thought again. That's what this conversation is going to be about, what it's already about. Our secrets, their power. Our plans, their agenda. Linda handed over the key, then asked Jackie if the girls had given her any problems.
"No seizures, if that's what you're worried about. Slept like lambs the whole time you were gone."
"What are we going to do about this?" Stacy asked.
She was a little thing, but determined.
"If you want to arrest Rennie, the 4 of us will have to convince Randolph to do it. We 3 women as officers, Rusty as the acting pathologist."
"No," Jackie and Linda said it together, Jackie with decisiveness, Linda with fright.
"We have a hypothesis, but no real proof," Jackie said. "I'm not sure Pete Randolph would believe us, even if we had surveillance photos of Big Jim snapping Brenda's neck. He and Rennie are in it together now, sink or swim. and most of the cops would come down on Pete's side.
Especially the new ones, Stacy said, and tugged at her cloud of blonde hair. A lot of them aren't very bright, but they're dedicated. And they like carrying guns.
Plus, she leaned forward,
there's 6 or 8 more of them tonight. Just high school kids, big and stupid and enthusiastic. They scare the hell out of me. And something else. Thibodeau, Searles, and Junior Rennie are asking the newbies to recommend even more. Give this a couple of days and it won't be a police force anymore. It'll be an army of teenagers.
No one would listen to us? Rusty asked. Not disbelieving exactly, simply trying to get it straight. No one at all?
Henry Morrison might, Jackie said. He sees what's happening and he doesn't like it. But the others?
They'll go along, partly because they're scared and partly because they like the power. Guys like Toby Whalen and George Frederick have never had any. Guys like Freddie Denton are just mean.
Which means what? Linda asked.
It means for now we keep this to ourselves. If Rennie's killed 4 people, he's very, very dangerous.
Waiting will make him more dangerous, not less, Rusty objected.
We have Judy and Janelle to worry about, Rusty, Linda said.
She was nipping at her nails, a thing Rusty hadn't seen her do in years.
We can't risk anything happening to them. I won't consider it, and I won't let you consider it.
I have a kid, too, Stacy said. Calvin.
He's just 5. It took all my courage just to stand guard at the funeral home tonight. The thought of taking this to that idiot Randolph.
She didn't need to finish. The pallor of her cheeks was eloquent.
No one's asking you to, Jackie said.
Right now, all I can prove is that the baseball was used on Coggins, Rusty said. Anyone could have used it. Hell, his own son could have used it.
That actually wouldn't come as a total shock to me, Stacy said. Junior's been weird lately. He got kicked out of Bowdoin for fighting. I don't know if his father knows it, but there was a police call to the gym where it happened, and I saw the report on the wire. And the 2 girls. If those were sex crimes...
They were, Rusty said. Very nasty. You don't want to know.
But Brenda wasn't sexually assaulted, Jackie said. To me, that suggests Coggins and Brenda were different from the girls.
Maybe Junior killed the girls and his old man killed Brenda and Coggins, Rusty said, and waited for someone to laugh. No one did.
If so, why?
They all shook their heads.
There must have been a motive, Rusty said, but I doubt if it was sex.
You think he has something to hide? Jackie said.
Yeah, I do, and I have an idea of someone who might know what it is. He's locked in the police department basement.
Barbara? Jackie asked.
Why would Barbara know?
Because he was talking to Brenda. They had quite a little heart-to-heart in her backyard the day after the dome came down.
How in the world do you know that? Stacy asked.
Because the Buffalinos live next door to the Perkinses, and Gina Buffalino's bedroom window overlooks the Perkins' backyard. She saw them and mentioned it to me.
He saw Linda looking at him and shrugged.
What can I say? It's a small town. We all support the team.
I hope you told her to keep her mouth shut, Linda said.
I didn't, because when she told me, I didn't have any reason to suspect Big Jim might have killed Brenda, or bash Lester Coggins' head in with a souvenir baseball. I didn't even know they were dead.
We still don't know if Barbie knows anything, Stacy said, other than how to make a hell of a mushroom and cheese omelet, that is.
Somebody will have to ask him, Jackie said.
I nominate me.
Even if he does know something, will it do any good? Linda asked.
This is almost a dictatorship now. I'm just realizing that. I guess that makes me slow.
It makes you more trusting than slow, Jackie said. And normally trusting's a good way to be. As to Colonel Barbara, we won't know what good he might do us until we ask. She paused.
And that's really not the point, you know. He's innocent. That's the point.
What if they kill him? Rusty asked bluntly. Shot while trying to escape.
I'm pretty sure that won't happen, Jackie said. Big Jim wants a show trial. That's the talk at the station.
Stacy nodded. They want to make people believe Barbara's a spider spinning a vast web of conspiracy. Then they can execute him. But even moving at top speed, that's days away, weeks if we're lucky.
We won't be that lucky, Linda said. Not if Rennie wants to move fast.
Maybe you're right, but Rennie's got the special town meeting to get through on Thursday first, and he'll want to question Barbara. If Rusty knows he's been with Brenda, then Rennie knows.
Of course he knows, Stacy said, sounding impatient. They were together when Barbara showed Jim the letter from the president.
They thought about this in silence for a minute.
If Rennie's hiding something, Linda mused, he'll want time to get rid of it.
Jackie laughed. The sound in that tense living room was almost shocking.
Good luck on that. Whatever it is, he can't exactly put it in the back of a truck and drive it out of town. Something to do with the propane? Linda asked.
Maybe, Rusty said. Jackie, you were in the service, right?
Army. 2 tours, military police. Never saw combat, although I saw plenty of casualties, especially on my 2nd tour. Würzburg, Germany. 1st Infantry Division. You know the big red one? Mostly I stopped bar fights or stood guard outside the hospital there. I knew guys like Barbie, and I would give a great deal to have him out of that cell and on our side. There was a reason the president put him in charge. Or tried to.
She paused.
It might be possible to break him out. It's worth considering.
The other two women, police officers who also happened to be mothers, said nothing to this. But Linda was nibbling her nails again, and Stacy was wearing her hair.
I know, Jackie said.
Linda shook her head.
Unless you have kids asleep upstairs and depending on you to make breakfast for them in the morning, you don't. Maybe not. But ask yourself this. If we're cut off from the outside world, which we are, and if the man in charge is a murderous nutball, which he may be, are things apt to get better if we just sit back and do nothing?
If you broke him out, Rusty said, what would you do with him? You can't exactly put him in the witness protection program.
I don't know, Jackie said and sighed. All I know is that the president ordered him to take charge and Big Jim fucking Rennie framed him for murder so he couldn't.
You're not going to do anything right away, Rusty said. Not even take the chance of talking to him. There's something else in play here. And it could change everything. He told them about the Geiger counter. How it had come into his possession, to whom he had passed it on, and what Joe McClatchy claimed to have found with it.
I don't know, Stacy said doubtfully. It seems too good to be true. The McClatchy boys, what, 14?
13, I think, but this is one bright kid, and if he says they got a radiation spike out on Black Ridge Road, I believe him. If they have found the thing generating the dome, and we can shut it down...
Then this ends, Linda cried.
Her eyes were bright.
And Jim Rennie collapses like a Macy's Thanksgiving Day balloon with a hole in it. Wouldn't that be nice, Jackie Weddington said. If it was on TV, I might even believe it.
17.
Phil? Andy called.
Phil?
He had to raise his voice to be heard. Bonnie Nandella and the Redemption were working through My Soul is a Witness at the top volume. All those ooh-oohs and whoa-yeahs were a little disorienting. Even the bright light inside the WCIK broadcast facility was disorienting. Until he stood beneath those fluorescents, Andy hadn't really realized how dark the rest of the mill had become and how much he'd adapted to it.
Chef?
No answer. He glanced at the TV, CNN with the sound off, then looked through the long window into the broadcast studio. The lights were on in there, too, and all the equipment was running. It gave him the creeps, even though Lester Coggins had explained with great pride how a computer ran everything. But there was no sign of Phil. All at once, he smelled sweat, old and sour. He turned, and Phil was standing right behind him as if he had popped out of the floor. He was holding what looked like a garage door opener in one hand. In the other was a pistol. The pistol was pointed at Andy's chest. The finger curled around the trigger was white at the knuckle, and the muzzle was trembling slightly.
Hello, Phil, Andy said. Chef, I mean.
What are you doing here?
Chef Bushy asked. The smell of his sweat was yeasty, overpowering. His jeans and WCIK t-shirt were grimy. His feet were bare. Probably accounting for his silent arrival,
and caked with dirt. His hair might last have been washed a year ago. Or not. His eyes were the worst, bloody and haunted.
You better tell me quick, old hoss, or you'll never tell anyone anything again.
Andy, who had narrowly cheated death by pink water not long before, received Chef's threat with equanimity, if not good cheer.
You do what you have to do, Phil. Chef. I mean.
Chef raised his eyebrows in surprise. It was bleary, but genuine.
Yeah?
Absolutely.
Why are you out here?
I come bearing bad news. I'm very sorry.
Chef considered this, then smiled, revealing his few surviving teeth.
There is no bad news. Christ is coming back. And that's the good news that swallows all bad news. That's the good news bonus track. Do you agree?
I do, and I say hallelujah. Unfortunately, or fortunately, I guess, you'd have to say fortunately, your wife is with him already.
Say what?
Andy reached out and pushed the muzzle of the gun floorward. Chef made no effort to stop him.
Samantha's dead, Chef. I regret to say, she took her own life earlier tonight.
Sammy, dead?
Chef dropped the gun into the out basket on a nearby desk. He also lowered the garage door opener but kept hold of it. For the last 2 days, it had not left his hand, even during his increasingly infrequent periods of sleep.
I'm sorry, Phil. Chef.
Andy explained the circumstances of Sammy's death as he understood them, concluding with the comforting news that the child was fine. Even in his despair, Andy Sanders was a glass-half-full person. Chef waved away little Walter's well-being with his garage door opener.
She off two pigs?
Andy stiffened at that.
They were police officers, Phil, fine human beings. She was distraught, I'm sure. But it was still a very bad thing to do. You need to take that back.
Say what?
I won't have you calling our officers pigs.
Chef considered.
Yeah, KK, I take it back.
Thank you.
Chef bent down from his not inconsiderable height. It was like being bowed to by a skeleton, and peered into Andy's face.
Brave little motherfucker, ain't you?
No, Andy said honestly. I just don't care.
Chef seemed to see something that concerned him. He grasped Andy's shoulder.
Brother, are you all right?
Andy burst into tears and dropped onto an office chair under a sign advising that Christ watcheth every channel. Christ listeneth every wavelength. He rested his head on the wall below this strangely sinister slogan, crying like a child who has been punished for stealing jam. It was the brother that had done it, that totally unexpected brother. Chef drew up a chair from behind the station manager's desk and studied Andy with the expression of a naturalist observing some rare animal in the wild. After a while, he said,
Sanders, did you come out here so I'd kill you?
No, Andy said through his sobs. Maybe, yes. I can't say. But everything in my life has gone wrong. My wife and daughter are dead. I think God might be punishing me for selling this shit. Chef nodded.
That could be.
And I'm looking for answers, or closure, or something. Of course, I also wanted to tell you about your wife. It's important to do the right thing.
Chef patted his shoulder.
You did, bro. I appreciate it. She wasn't much shakes in the kitchen. And she didn't keep house no better than a hog in a shit heap. But she could throw an unearthly fuck when she was stoned. What did she have against those two blue boys?
Even in his grief, Andy had no intention of bringing up the rape accusation.
I suppose she was upset about the dome. Do you know about the dome, Phil? Chef?
Chef waved his hand again, apparently in the affirmative.
What you say about the meth is correct. Selling it is wrong. An affront. Making it, though, that is God's will.
Andy dropped his hands and peered at Chef from his swollen eyes.
Do you think so? Because I'm not sure that can be right.
Have you ever had any?
No, Andy cried. It was as if Chef had asked him if he had ever enjoyed sexual congress with a cocker spaniel.
Would you take medicine if the doctor prescribed it?
Well, yes, of course, but...
Meth is medicine.
Chef looked at him solemnly, then tapped Andy's chest with a finger for emphasis. Chef had nibbled the nail all the way to the bloody quick.
Meth is medicine. Say it.
Meth is medicine, Andy repeated, agreeably enough.
That's right. Chef stood up. It's a medicine for melancholy. That's from Ray Bradbury. You ever read Ray Bradbury?
No.
He's a fucking head. He knew. He wrote the motherfucking book, Say Hallelujah. Come with me. I'm going to change your life.
18. The first selectman of Chester's Mill took to meth like a frog to flies. There was a ratty old couch behind the ranked cookers, and here Andy and Chef Bushy sat under a picture of Christ on a motorcycle, titled Your Unseen Road Buddy, passing a pipe back and forth. While burning, meth smells like three-day-old piss in an uncovered thunder jug. But after his first tentative puff, Andy felt positive that the chef was right. Selling it might be Satan's work, but the stuff itself had to be God's. The world jumped into an exquisite, delicately trembling focus he had never seen before. His heart rate spiked. The blood vessels in his neck swelled to throbbing cables. His gums tingled, and his balls crawled in the most delightfully adolescent way. Better than any of these things, the weariness that had lain on his shoulders and muddled up his thinking disappeared. He felt he could move mountains in a wheelbarrow.
In the Garden of Eden there was a tree, Chef said, passing him the pipe.
Tendrils of green smoke drifted from both ends.
The tree of good and evil, dig that shit?
Yes, it's in the Bible.
Bet you're jackdog. And on that tree was an apple.
Right, right.
Andy took a puff so small it was actually a sip. He wanted more, he wanted it all, but feared that if he helped himself to a deep lungful, his head would explode off his neck and fly around the lab like a rocket, shooting fiery exhaust from its stump.
The flesh of that apple is truth, and the skin of that apple is meth,
Chef said. Andy looked at him.
That's amazing.
Chef nodded.
Yes, Sanders, it is.
He took back the pipe.
Is this good shit or what?
Amazing shit.
Christ is coming back on Halloween, Chef said. Possibly a few days earlier, I can't tell. It's already the Halloween season, you know. Season of the motherfucking witch.
He handed Andy the pipe, then pointed with the hand holding the garage door opener.
Do you see that? Up at the end of the gallery, over the door to the storage side.
Andy looked.
What? That white lump looks like clay?
That's not clay, Chef said. That's the body of Christ, Sanders.
What about those wires coming out of it?
Vessels, with the blood of Christ running through them.
Andy considered this concept and found it quite brilliant.
Good.
He considered some more.
I love you, Phil. Chef. I mean, I'm glad I came out here.
Me too, Chef said. Listen, do you want to go for a ride? I've got a car here somewhere, I think, but I'm a little shaky.
Sure, Andy said. He stood up. The world swam for a moment or two, then steadied.
Where do you want to go?
Chef told him. 19. Ginny Tomlinson was asleep at the reception desk with her head on the cover of a People magazine, Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie frolicking in the surf on some horny little island where waiters brought you drinks with little paper parasols stuck in them. When something woke her up at 1:45 on Wednesday morning, an apparition was standing before her. A tall, scrawny man with hollow eyes, and hair that stuck out in all directions. He was wearing a WCIK t-shirt and jeans that floated low on his meager hips. At first she thought she was having a nightmare about walking corpses, but then she caught a whiff of him. No dream had ever smelled that bad.
"I'm Phil Bushy," the apparition said. "I've come for my wife's body. I'm going to bury her. Show me where it is."
Ginny didn't argue. She would have given him all the bodies just to get rid of him. She led him past Gina Buffalino, who stood next to a gurney, watching Chef with pale apprehension. When he turned to look at her, she shrank back.
"Got your Halloween costume, kid?" Chef inquired.
"Yes."
"Who you gonna be?"
"Glinda," the girl said faintly. "Although, I guess I won't be going to the party, after all. It's in Mottin."
"I'm coming as Jesus," Chef said.
He followed Ginny, a dirty ghost in decaying Converse high tops. Then he turned back. He was smiling. His eyes were empty.
"And am I pissed?"
20. Chef Bushy came out of the hospital 10 minutes later, bearing Sammy's sheet-wrapped body in his arms. One barefoot, the toenails painted with chipped pink polish, knotted and dipped. Ginny held the door for him. She didn't look to see who was behind the wheel of the car idling in the turnaround, and for this Andy was vaguely grateful. He waited until she'd gone back inside, then got out, and opened one of the back doors for Chef, who handled his burden easily for a man who now looked like no more than skin wrapped on an armature of bone. Perhaps, Andy thought, meth conveys strength, too. If so, his own was flagging. The depression was creeping back in. The weariness, too.
"All right," Chef said. "Drive. But pass me that first."
He had given Andy the garage door opener for safekeeping. Andy handed it over.
"To the funeral parlor?"
Chef looked at him as if he were mad.
"Back out to the radio station. That's where Christ will come first when he comes back."
"On Halloween?"
"That's right," Chef said. "Or maybe sooner. In the meantime, will you help me bury this child of God?"
"Of course," Andy said. Then timidly, "Maybe we could smoke a little more first."
Chef laughed and clapped Andy on the shoulder.
"Like it, don't you? I knew you would."
"A medicine for melancholy," Andy said.
"True dat, brother. True dat."
21. Barbie on the bunk waiting for dawn and whatever came next. He had trained himself during his time in Iraq not to worry about what came next. And although this was an imperfect skill at best, he had mastered it to some degree. In the end, there were only two rules for living with fear. He had come to believe conquering fear was a myth. And he repeated them to himself now as he lay waiting. "I must accept those things over which I have no control. I must turn my adversities into advantages." The second rule meant carefully husbanding any resources and planning with those in mind. He had one resource tucked into the mattress, his Swiss Army knife. It was a small one, only two blades, but even the short one would be capable of cutting a man's throat. He was incredibly lucky to have it, and he knew it. Whatever intake routines Howard Perkins might have insisted upon had fallen apart since his death, and the ascension of Peter Randolph. The shocks the town had endured over the last 4 days would have knocked any police department off its pins, Barbie supposed. But there was more to it than that. What it came down to was Randolph was both stupid and sloppy. And in any bureaucracy, the rank and file tended to take their cues from the man at the top. They had fingerprinted him and photographed him, but it had been 5 full hours before Henry Morrison, looking tired and disgusted, came downstairs and stopped 6 feet from Barbie's cell, well out of grabbing distance. "Forget something, did you?" Barbie asked.
"Dump out your pockets and shove everything into the corridor," Henry said. "Then take off your pants and put them through the bars."
"If I do that, can I get something to drink? I don't have to slurp out of the toilet bowl."
"What are you talking about? Junior brought you water. I saw him."
"He poured salt in it."
"Right, absolutely."
But Henry had looked a little unsure. Maybe there was a thinking human being still in there somewhere.
Do what I tell you, Barbie. Barbara, I mean.
Barbie emptied his pockets, wallet, keys, coins, a little fold of bills. The St. Christopher's medal he carried as a good luck charm. By then the Swiss Army knife was long gone into the mattress. You can still call me Barbie when you put a rope around my neck and hang me if you want. Is that what Rennie's got in mind? Hanging? Or a firing squad?
Just shut up and shove your pants through the bars, shirt too.
He sounded like a total small-town hard-ass, but Barbie thought he looked more unsure than ever. That was good. That was a start. Two of the new kitty cops had come downstairs. One held a can of mace, the other a taser.
Need any help, Officer Morrison? One asked.
No, but you can stand right there at the foot of the stairs and keep an eye out until I'm done here, Henry had said.
I didn't kill anybody. Barbie spoke quietly, but with all the honest sincerity he could muster. And I think you know it.
What I know is that you better shut up unless you want a taser enema.
Henry had rummaged through his clothes but didn't ask Barbie to strip down to his underpants and spread his cheeks. A late search and piss poor, but Barbie gave him some points for remembering to do one at all. No one else had. When Henry had finished, he kicked the blue jeans, pockets now empty and belt confiscated, back through the bars. May I have my medallion?
No.
Henry, think about this. Why would I...
Shut up.
Henry pushed past the two kitty cops with his head down and Barbie's personal effects in his hands. The kitty cops followed, one pausing long enough to grin at Barbie, and saw a finger across his neck. Since then he'd been alone, with nothing to do but lie on the bunk and look up at the little slit of a window, opaque pebbled glass reinforced with wire, waiting for the dawn, and wondering if they would actually try to waterboard him, or if Searles had just been gassing out his ass. If they took a shot at it, and turned out to be as bad at boarding as they had been at prisoner intake, there was a good chance they'd drown him. He also wondered if someone might come down before dawn. Someone with a key. Someone who might stand a little too close to the door. With the knife, escape was not completely out of the question, but once dawn came, it probably would be. Maybe he should have tried for Junior when Junior passed the glass of salt water through the bars. Only Junior had been very eager to use his sidearm. It would have been a long chance, and Barbie wasn't that desperate. At least not yet. Besides, where would I go? Even if he escaped and disappeared, he could be letting his friends in for a world of hurt. After strenuous questioning by cops like Melvin and Junior, they might consider the dome the least of their problems. Big Jim was in the saddle now, and once guys like him were in it, they tended to ride hard, sometimes until the horse collapsed beneath them. He fell into a thin and troubled sleep. He dreamed of the blonde in the old Ford pick-em-up. He dreamed that she stopped for him, and they got out of Chester's mill just in time. She was unbuttoning her blouse to display the cups of a lacy lavender bra when a voice said, "Hey there, fuckstick, wakey wakey." 22. Jackie Weddington spent the night at the Everett House, and although the kids were quiet and the guest room bed was comfortable, she lay awake. By 4 o'clock that morning, she had decided what needed to be done. She understood the risks. She also understood that she couldn't rest with Barbie in a cell under the police department. If she herself had been capable of stepping up and organizing some sort of resistance, or just a serious investigation of the murders, she thought she would have started already. She knew herself too well, however, to even entertain the thought. She had been good enough at what she did in Guam and Germany, rousting drunk troops out of bars, chasing AWOLs, and cleaning up after car crashes on the base was what it mostly came down to. But what was happening in Chester's Mill was far beyond a master sergeant's pay grade, or the only full-time female street officer working with a bunch of small-town men who called her Officer Bazooms behind her back. They thought she didn't know this, but she did. And right now a little junior high school-level sexism was the least of her worries. This had to end, and Dale Barbara was the man the President of the United States had picked to end it. Even the pleasure of the Commander-in-Chief wasn't the most important part. The first rule was, you didn't leave your guys behind. That was sacred. The fabled automatic. It had to begin with letting Barbie know he wasn't alone. Then he could plan his own actions accordingly. When Linda came downstairs in her nightgown at 5 o'clock, first light had begun to seep in through the windows, revealing trees and bushes that were perfectly still. Not a breath of breeze was stirring.
"I need a Tupperware," Jackie said, "a bowl. It should be small and it needs to be opaque. Do you have anything like that?" "Sure, but why?"
"Because we're going to take Dale Barbara his breakfast," Jackie said. "Cereal. And we're going to put a note in the bottom of it."
"What are you talking about, Jackie? I can't do that. I've got kids."
"I know, but I can't do it alone because they won't let me go down there on my own. Maybe if I was a man, but not equipped with these." She indicated her breasts. "I need you."
"What kind of note?"
"I'm going to break him out tomorrow night," Jackie said, more calmly than she felt. "During the big town meeting, I won't need you for that part."
"You won't get me for that part."
Linda was clutching the neck of her nightgown.
"Keep your voice down. I'm thinking maybe Romeo Burpee. Assuming I can convince him Barbie didn't kill Brenda.
We'll wear balaclavas or something so we can't be identified. No one will be surprised. Everyone in this town already thinks he has cohorts."
"You're insane."
"No. There'll be nothing but a skeleton crew at the PD during the meeting. 3-4 guys. Maybe only a couple. I'm sure of it."
"I'm not."
"But tomorrow night's a long way away. He has to string them along at least that far. Now, get me that bowl."
"Jackie, I can't do this."
"Yes, you can." It was Rusty, standing in the doorway and looking relatively enormous in a pair of gym shorts and a New England Patriots t-shirt. "It's time to start taking risks, kids or no kids. We're on our own here, and this has got to stop." Linda looked at him for a moment, biting her lip. Then she bent to one of the lower cabinets.
"The Tupperware's down here."
23. When they came into the police station, the duty desk was unmanned. Freddie Denton had gone home to catch some sleep. But half a dozen of the younger officers were sitting around, drinking coffee and talking, high enough on excitement to get up at an hour few of them had experienced in a conscious state for a long time. Among them, Jackie saw two of the multitudinous Killian brothers, a small-town biker chick, and Dipper's habitué named Lauren Connery, and Carter Thibodeau. The others she couldn't name, but she recognized two as chronic truants from high school, who had also been in on various minor drug and MV violations. The new officers, the newest of the new, weren't wearing uniforms but had swatches of blue cloth tied around their upper arms. All but one were wearing guns.
"What are you two doing up so early?" Thibodeau asked, strolling over. "I got an excuse. Ran out of pain pills." The others guffawed like trolls.
"Brought breakfast for Barbara," Jackie said.
She was afraid to look at Linda, afraid of what expression she might see on Linda's face. Thibodeau peered into the bowl.
"No milk?"
"He doesn't need milk," Jackie said, and spit into the bowl of Special K. "I'll wet it down for him."
A cheer went up from the others. Several clapped. Jackie and Linda got as far as the stairs before Thibodeau said,
"Gimme that."
For a moment, Jackie froze. She saw herself flinging the bowl at him, then taking to her heels. What stopped her was a simple fact. They had nowhere to run. Even if they made it out of the station, they'd be collared before they could get past the war memorial. Linda took the Tupperware bowl from Jackie's hands and held it out. Thibodeau peered into it. Then, instead of investigating the cereal for hidden treats, he spat into it himself.
"My contribution," he said.
Wait a minute,
the Connery girl said. She was a rangy redhead with a model's body and acne-ravaged cheeks. Her voice was a little foggy because she had one finger rammed up her nose to the second knuckle.
"I got something, too."
Her finger emerged with a large booger riding the end of it. Miss Connery deposited it on top of the cereal to more applause and someone's cry of, "Lori mines for the green gold."
"Every box of cereal's supposed to have a toy surprise in it,"
she said, smiling vacantly. She dropped her hand to the butt of the .45 she was wearing. Thin as she was, Jackie thought the recoil would probably blow her right off her feet if she ever had occasion to fire it.
All set, Thibodeau said. I'll keep you company.
Good, Jackie said. And when she thought of how close she'd come to just putting the note in her pocket and trying to hand it to Barbie, she felt cold. All at once, the risk they were taking seemed insane, but it was too late now. Stay back by the stairs, though. And Linda, you keep behind me. We take no chances.
She thought he might argue that, but he didn't. 24. Barbie sat up on the bunk. On the other side of the bar stood Jackie Weddington with a white plastic bowl in one hand. Behind her, Linda Everett had her gun drawn and held in a double fist, pointing at the floor. Carter Thibodeau was last in line at the foot of the stairs, with his hair in sleep spikes and his blue uniform shirt unbuttoned to show the bandage covering the dog bite on his shoulder.
Hello, Officer Weddington, Barbie said.
Thin white light was creeping in through his slit of a window. It was the kind of first light that makes life seem like the joke of jokes. I'm innocent of all accusations. I can't call them charges, because I haven't been...
Shut up, Linda said from behind her. We're not interested.
Tell it, Blondie, Carter said. You go, girl.
He yawned and scratched at the bandage.
Sit right there, Jackie said. Don't you move a muscle.
Barbie sat. She pushed the plastic bowl through the bars. It was small and just fit. He picked up the bowl. It was filled with what looked like Special K. Spit gleamed on top of the dry cereal. Something else as well. A large green booger, damp and threaded with blood. And still his stomach rumbled. He was very hungry. He was also hurt, in spite of himself, because he'd thought Jackie Weddington, whom he had spotted as ex-military the first time he saw her, it was partly the haircut, mostly her way of carrying herself, was better than this. It had been easy to deal with Henry Morrison's disgust. This was harder. And the other woman cop, the one married to Rusty Everett, was looking at him as if he were some rare species of stinging bug. He had hoped at least some of the department's regular officers.
Eat up, Thibodeau called from his place on the steps. We fixed it nice for you, didn't we, girls?
We did, Linda agreed.
The corners of her mouth twitched down. It was little more than a tick. But Barbie's heart lightened. He thought she was faking. Maybe that was hoping for too much, but... She moved slightly, blocking Thibodeau's line of sight to Jackie with her body. Although there was no real need, Thibodeau was otherwise occupied with trying to peek under the edge of his bandage. Jackie glanced back to make sure she was clear, then pointed to the bowl, turned her hands up, and raised her eyebrows. Sorry. After that, she pointed two fingers at Barbie. Pay attention. He nodded. Enjoy it, fuckstick, Jackie said. We'll get you something better at noon. I'm thinking piss burger. From the stairs, where he was now picking at the edges of the bandage, Thibodeau gave a bark of laughter.
If you've got any teeth left to eat it with, Linda said.
Barbie wished she had kept silent. She didn't sound sadistic or even angry. She only sounded scared. A woman who wished to be anywhere but here. Thibodeau, however, didn't seem to notice. He was still investigating the state of his shoulder.
Come on, Jackie said. I don't want to watch him eat.
That wet enough for you? Thibodeau asked.
He stood up as the women came down the corridor between the cells to the stairs, Linda reholstering her weapon.
"'Cause if it's not..."
He hawked back phlegm.
"'I'll make do,' Barbie said.
"'Course you will,' Thibodeau said. "'For a while. Then you won't.'
They went up the stairs. Thibodeau went last and gave Jackie a whack on the butt. She laughed and slapped at him. She was good. A lot better than the Everett woman. But they had both just shown plenty of guts. Fearsome guts. Barbie picked the booger off the Special K and flicked it toward the corner he'd pissed in. He wiped his hands on his shirt, Then he began to dig down through the cereal. At the bottom, his fingers found a slip of paper. "Try to make it until tomorrow night. If we can get you out, can you think of a safe place? You know what to do with this." Barbie did. 25. An hour after he ate the note and then the cereal, heavy footsteps slowly descended the stairs. It was Big Jim Rennie, already dressed in a suit and a tie for another day of Under the Dome administration. He was followed by Carter Thibodeau and another fellow, Killian, judging by the shape of his head. The Killian boy was carrying a chair and making difficulties with it. He was what old-time Yankees would have called a gormy lad. He handed the chair to Thibodeau, who placed it in front of the cell at the end of the corridor. Rennie sat down, delicately tweezing his pants leg first to preserve the crease.
"Good morning, Mr. Barbara."
There was a slight, satisfied emphasis on the civilian title. "Selectman Rennie," Barbie said. "What can I do for you besides give you my name, rank, and serial number, which I'm not sure I remember?"
"Confess. Save us some trouble and soothe your own soul."
"Mr. Searles mentioned something last night about waterboarding," Barbie said. "He asked me if I'd ever seen it in Iraq." Rennie's mouth was pursed in a slight smile that seemed to say, "Tell me more. Talking animals are so interesting." "In fact, I did. I have no idea how often the technique was actually used in the field. Reports varied, but I saw it twice. One of the men confessed, although his confession was worthless. The man he named as an Al-Qaeda bomb maker turned out to be a school teacher who'd left Iraq for Kuwait 14 months previous. The other man had a convulsion and suffered brain damage, so there was no confession from him. Had he been capable, though, I'm sure he would have given one. Everybody confesses when they're waterboarded, usually in a matter of minutes. I'm sure I would, too."
"Then save yourself some grief," Big Jim said.
"You look tired, sir. Are you well?" The tiny smile was replaced by a tiny frown. It emanated from the deep crease between Rennie's eyebrows.
"My current condition is none of your concern. A word of advice, Mr. Barbara. Don't bullspit me, and I won't bullspit you. What you should be concerned about is your own condition. It may be fine now, but that could change in a matter of minutes. You see, I am indeed thinking of having you waterboarded. Am, in fact, seriously considering it. So, confess to these murders. Save yourself a lot of pain and trouble."
"I think not. And if you waterboard me, I'm apt to talk about all sorts of things. Probably ought to keep that in mind when you decide who you want in the room when I start talking." Rennie considered this. Although he was neatly put together, especially for such an early hour, his complexion was sallow, and his small eyes were rimmed with purple flesh-like bruises. He really did not look well. If Big Jim just dropped dead, Barbie could see two possible results. One was that the ugly political weather in the mill would clear without spawning any further tornadoes. The other was a chaotic bloodbath, in which Barbie's own death, quite likely by lynching rather than firing squad, would be followed by a purge of his suspected co-conspirators. Julia might be first on that list, and Rose could be number two. Frightened people were great believers in guilt by association. Rennie turned to Thibodeau.
"Step back, Carter. All the way to the stairs, if you please. But if he makes a grab for you, then you'd kill him, and he knows it, don't you, Mr. Barbara?"
Barbie nodded.
"Besides, I'm not getting any closer than this, which is why I want you to step back. We're having a private conversation here."
Thibodeau stepped back.
"Now, Mr. Barbara, what things would you talk about?"
"I know all about the meth lab." Barbie kept his voice pitched low. "Chief Perkins knew, and he was getting ready to arrest you. Brenda found the file on his computer. It's why you killed her." Rennie smiled.
"That's an ambitious fantasy."
"The state attorney general won't think so, given your motive. We're not talking about some half-assed cook-up in a mobile home. This is the General Motors of meth."
By the end of the day, Rennie said, Perkins' computer will be destroyed. Hers as well. I suppose there may be a copy of certain papers in Duke's home safe. Meaningless, of course. Vicious, politically motivated garbage from the mind of a man who always loathed me. And if so, the safe will be opened and the papers will be burned. For the town's good, not mine. This is a crisis situation. We all need to pull together. Brenda passed on a copy of that file before she died. Big Jim grinned, revealing a double row of tiny teeth. One confabulation deserves another, Mr. Barbara. Shall I confabulate? Barbie spread his hands. Be my guest. In my confabulation, Brenda comes to see me and tells me that same thing. She says she gave the copy of which you speak to Julius Shumway, but I know it's a lie. She may have meant to, but she did not. Even if she had. He shrugged. Your cohorts burned down Shumway's newspaper last night. That was a bad decision on their part. Or was it your idea? Barbara repeated, There is another copy. I know where it is. If you waterboard me, I will confess that location. Loudly. Rennie laughed. Put with great sincerity, Mr. Barbara, but I've spent my whole life dickering and I know a bluff when I hear one. Perhaps I should just have you summarily executed. The town would cheer. How loudly, if you did it without discovering my co-conspirators first. Even Peter Randolph might question that decision, and he's nothing but a dumb and frightened lickspittle. Big Jim stood up. His hanging cheeks had gone the color of old brick. You don't know who you're playing with here. Sure I do. I saw your kind again and again in Iraq. They wear turbans instead of ties, but otherwise they're just the same, right down to the blather about God.
Well, you've talked me out of waterboarding, Big Jim said. It's a shame, too, because I always wanted to see it firsthand.
I'll bet.
For now, we'll just keep you in this cozy cell, all right? I don't think you'll eat much because eating interferes with thinking. Who knows? With constructive thinking, you may come up with better reasons for me to allow you to go on living. The names of those in town who are against me, for instance. A complete list. I'll give you 48 hours. Then if you can't convince me otherwise, you'll be executed in War Memorial Plaza with the entire town looking on. You'll serve as an object lesson.
You really don't look well, Selectman.
Rennie studied him gravely.
It's your kind that causes most of the trouble in the world. If I didn't think your execution would serve this town as a unifying principle and a much-needed catharsis, I'd have Mr. Thibodeau shoot you right now.
Do that, and it all comes out, Barbie said. People from one end of this town to the other will know about your operation. Try getting a consensus at your motherfucking town meeting then, you tinpot tyrant.
The veins swelled on the sides of Big Jim's neck. Another beat in the center of his forehead. For a moment, he looked on the verge of exploding. Then he smiled.
A for effort, Mr. Barbara. But you lie.
He left. They all left. Barbie sat on his bunk, sweating. He knew how close to the edge he was. Rennie had reasons to keep him alive, but not strong ones. And then there was the note delivered by Jackie Weddington and Linda Everett. The expression on Mrs. Everett's face suggested that she knew enough to be terrified, and not just for herself. It would have been safer for him to try and escape using the knife. Given the current level of professionalism in the Chester's Mill PD, he thought it could be done. It would take a little luck, but it could be done. He had, however, no way of telling them to let him try it on his own. Barbie lay down and put his hands behind his head. One question nagged him above all others. What had happened to the copy of the Vader file meant for Julia? Because it hadn't reached her. About that, he was sure Rennie had been telling the truth. No way of knowing. And nothing to do but wait. Lying on his back, looking up at the ceiling, Barbie began to do it.
Play that dead band song.
1. When Linda and Jackie came back from the PD, Rusty and the girls were sitting on the front step waiting for them. The Jays were still in their 90s, light cotton ones, not the flannels they were used to at this time of year. Although it was still not quite 7 a.m., the thermometer outside the kitchen window had the temperature at 66 degrees. Ordinarily, the two girls would have flown down the walk to embrace their mother far in advance of Rusty, but this morning he beat them by several yards. He seized Linda around the waist and she wrapped her arms around his neck with almost painful tightness. Not a hello handsome hug, but a drowner's grip.
"Are you all right?" he whispered in her ear.
Her hair brushed up and down against his cheek as she nodded. Then she drew back. Her eyes were shining.
"I was sure Thibodeau would look in the cereal. It was Jackie's idea to spit in it. That was genius, but I was certain."
"Why is Mommy crying?" Judy asked.
She sounded ready to cry herself.
"I'm not," she said, then wiped her eyes. "Well, maybe a little, because I'm so happy to see your dad."
"We're all happy to see him," Janelle told Jackie, "because my daddy, he's the boss."
"News to me," Rusty said, then kissed Linda on the mouth hard.
"Lips kissing," Janelle said, fascinated.
Judy covered her eyes and giggled.
"Come on, girls, swings," Jackie said. "Then you get dressed for school."
"I want to loopy the loop,"
Janelle screamed, leading the way.
"School?" Rusty asked. "Really?"
"Really," Linda said. "Just the little ones at East Street Grammar. Half a day, Wendy Goldstone and Ellen Van Destine volunteered to take classes. K through 3 in one room, 4 through 6 in another. I don't know if any actual learning will happen, but it'll give the kids a place to go, and a sense of normalcy, maybe."
She looked up at the sky, which was cloudless, but had a yellowish tinge all the same. Like a blue eye with a cataract growing on it, she thought.
"I could use some normalcy myself. Look at that sky."
Rusty glanced up briefly, then held his wife at arm's length so he could study her.
"You got away with it? You sure?"
"Yes, but it was close. This kind of thing may be fun in spy movies, but in real life it's awful. I won't break him out, honey. Because of the girls."
"Dictators always hold the children hostage," Rusty said. "At some point people have to say that no longer works."
"But not here and not yet. This is Jackie's idea, so let her handle it. I won't be a part of it, and I won't let you be a part of it."
Yet he knew that if he demanded this of her, she would do as he asked. It was the expression under her expression. If that made him the boss he didn't want to be.
"You're going into work?" he asked.
"Of course. Kids go to MARTA. MARTA takes kids to school. Linda and Jackie report for another day of police work under the dome. Anything else would look funny. I hate having to think this way."
She blew out a breath.
"Also, I'm tired."
She glanced to make sure the kids were out of earshot.
"Fucking exhausted. I hardly slept at all. Are you going into the hospital?"
Rusty shook his head. "Ginny and Twitch are going to be on their own at least until noon. Although, with the new guy to help them out, I think they'll be okay. Thurston's kind of new agey, but he's good. I'm going over to Claire McClatchy's. I need to talk to those kids. And I need to go out to where they got the radiation spike on the Geiger counter."
"What do I tell people who ask where you are?"
Rusty considered this.
"The truth, I guess. Some of it, anyway. Say I'm investigating a possible dome generator. That might make Rennie think twice about whatever next step he's planning."
"And when I'm asked about the location, because I will be."
"Say you don't know, but you think it's on the western side of town."
"Blackridge is north."
"Yep. If Rennie tells Randolph to send out some of his Mounties, I want them to go to the wrong place. If someone calls you on it later, just say you were tired and must have gotten mixed up. And listen, hun, before you go into the PD, make a list of people who may believe Barbie's innocent of the murders."
Thinking again, us and them.
"We need to talk to those people before the town meeting tomorrow, very discreetly."
"Rusty, are you sure about this? Because after the fire last night, this whole town is going to be on the lookout for the friends of Dale Barbara."
"Am I sure? Yes. Do I like it? Most assuredly not."
She looked up again at the yellow-tinged sky, then at the two oaks.